We're winding up our study in Kant, and we've covered the categorical imperative. This idea of the source of ethics is that reason itself, which is the hallmark of our very nature, commands us not to do some things, because when you universalize them, write them down as though they're a law that holds for the reality you live in, that law then is self-contradictory or self-defeating or inconsistent with the way the world really is, or it's the rule, always be sure to treat humans as ends, not as means. Don't just use people. And I said that this didn't cover the ground entirely. It certainly doesn't have the universal applicability that the Christian idea of love your neighbor as yourself has. It comes close to doing to others as you'd have them do unto you. That's true. He wants to get as close. He wants his ethics to be as all applicable, as transcendental as the Christian ethic is. But I don't think he makes it. Think about this. And this is the kind of stuff that we get in ethics books all the time. You're standing near a railroad track, and you're right near the switch. And the railroad track diverges up in front of ahead of you, and there's a train coming from behind you. And there are two platforms, one on the left, your left, one on your right, and there are people on each platform. And this train is runaway. And you know that. It's going way too fast, and when it gets to whichever track it turns onto, it's going to come off the track and barrel into whatever people are standing at that station. On the one station, there's 100 people, and the other, there's 10. Which one do you, and you've got the switch in your hand, you can make the train go to one or the other. What do you do? Now, how does treat people like ends and not means, or how does the earlier formulations of the categorical imperative tell you what to do? Do I pull the train, send it to the right track or the left? Have I a duty to save more people if there's more going to be killed on the left side? And suppose I have reason to believe, and I can see the evidence in front of me, that the crash will be more severe on the side with fewer people. It's going to wipe them out. But many people on the left side, it won't be so severe. And there's just a chance that it might overturn after it gets by them. Which one do I pick? I don't see that the categorical imperative in any of its three versions tells me what to do there. Or think of a classic such as Sophie's Choice by Styron. The evil Nazi officer tells the young mother, choose which one of your infants you want to survive, and I'll take the other one to the death camps. And if you say neither, I'll take both. In fact, I'll put you there too. How does it help you in a spot like that? What's the right thing to do? The Christian ethic includes the recognition that there are sometimes cases in which all of your options are evil. You choose the lesser evil rather than a good. I think I'd try to kill the Nazi officer, but it's another discussion for another day. I mean, Kant's got only the categorical imperative. It just doesn't answer all of the moral dilemmas that we could be put in. None of the three versions tell us who to rescue and who not. Now, it's at this point that Kant brings God back into the picture here for his ethics. And he says that there is a practical, not logical, proof of God. And this practical proof is that even though we encounter this as an idea of the reason, it's a way of, it organizes our experience. And it does so in ways that we can't duplicate without belief in God. So this practical proof of God means that we need this idea and we should live as if it were true. And this he wants to help reinforce the ethics. The ethics is a command to us, not from God, but from our rational nature. Reason itself commands. And we have a duty to reason, and it's out of that recognition that we should have respect for the moral law. But now he wants to bring, he realizes that may not do the trick. He wants to bring God back in and say, well, we're supposed to be living as if this were a true idea. I don't know that even this is going to tell us what to do in the cases of those choices where there is no good choice, there's only evil, and we try to do the lesser evil. I think that's recognized. Luther does, for example. He says there are times and places that there's nothing good that can be done, and if we don't act at all, that's not good either. And I think that's where he says, in that case, sin boldly. Just take one of the things and do it. But even more boldly, trust Christ for forgiveness. Well, not bad advice, I guess. But Kant's not got that. You just heard the hatchet job he did on the Christian story of the incarnation of God coming down from heaven, taking on the form of a man and living and dying among us. Well, that's a great story. So, live as if it were true. It's not. I don't know what kind of advice that is. Foolish, I guess I'd call it. But he makes the argument. He goes ahead. The goal of a good life, the moral life, is happiness. And we need the idea of God to be happier than we'd otherwise be. Now this is so live as though God is real and Christ has been incarnated on earth. And of course, on earth means in somebody or other's experience. And that's his best advice. Now, he adds something else here. God doesn't just back up these laws. He actually repeats them. He gives them in the Ten Commandments and in the commandment of love. But Kant wants to say, we have the idea of God as judge, and that's a really valuable one. So what he wants to say is that the practical justification of belief in God is that everyone naturally thinks So maybe this should be an idea of the reason too. He doesn't say that, but everyone naturally thinks that good should be rewarded. And evil punished. Even if the reward is just the praising somebody for having done so, or recognizing, good job. I think everyone likes that. You don't like to see something fairly stand out as exceptionally good that they just did. Be completely ignored. Everybody goes on ho-hum, ignores it. At least give the person the credit. And evil should be punished. Now, that too is in the New Testament. Christianity believes in the day of judgment. But the highest possible good, this is Kant's argument, this idea that everyone naturally thinks is equivalent to wanting the highest possible good. And so, God is not only an idea of the reason, that's how this idea can originate, but God is a postulate. You know what that means? It means God is a guess, is a theory, a proposal of moral reason. If morality needs us to think that God has commanded it, then we should think God has commanded it. That's what this comes down to. God's a theory, a guess. This isn't just an idea of the reason, it's also a judge of good and evil. And it will somehow see to it that good is rewarded and evil is punished. Well, it ain't the Christian idea. Christian idea is that there's a judgment and God is judge. But that's because God created us and the entire universe, and he will hold everyone, every moral being, responsible for what they do. And that in the end, as the book of Revelation puts it, every knee will bow and every tongue confess of every creature in heaven and earth that Christ is Lord, to the glory of God the Father. It's going to be a real deal, not just the idea of a judgment. And this is a practical need we have. Therefore, treat God as real, even though he's not. The guy speaks out of two sides of his mouth. He wants us to believe that the critique of pure reason is right in how we know things, and that there are some things we can't know, and they include God. But now when he gets to the ethics, but we can make our minds up to act as though it were true, you know, like the great pumpkin. Just sit out here in the pumpkin patch and freeze and wait for him to show up, because he'll show up if you believe it. Yeah. His hope here that comes through to me is that what he wants to revive is that, with respect to ethics, not only is the real rational, but the rational is real. See, it makes rational sense to think that the good will be rewarded and the evil will be punished. Therefore, we postulate the existence of God to do that and to make ethics come out the way reason appears to be geared for it to come out. He's, and everywhere else, rejected that the rational is real. But now he's trying to revive it, sneak it back in, call it by something else, call it a practical need, and say practical reason requires us to make this postulate. And of course, with that, see, it not only saves God, God is a guess of moral reason. But so then is the doctrine of everlasting life. Because God then sets before us the task of a morally perfect life. That's the way the New Testament describes those who have been raised from the dead, have entered God's kingdom. There's no more sin. There's no more wrongdoing. There's no more sorrow and suffering. In that picture, any evil, any grief that earth can impose on people is more than made up for in heaven. And that's a goal that we never can quite reach. So Kant says, therefore, it extends forever for us improving ourselves and always being more moral than we were the day before or the week before or the month before. That's the way he pictures this. All this is a picture that we have to give to ourselves and live by. And why do we have to do that? Well, because we need to. Not because it's true. Which I think is the only reason to believe anything. Okay. Notice what happens with these postulates. This, he argues for believing that God is real because it's not only an idea of the reason, but a guess of the moral reason. So moral reason comes back and says, oh, but you need this in order to be, for enforcement. And then there's everlasting life. You need this as an inducement. The he calls it the immortality of the soul. But, of course, what the New Testament describes is the resurrection of the body. Body and soul, we will live in God's kingdom. And God's kingdom is said to be on this earth. Okay. So, what's the Christian take on this? Well, according to Christian teaching, God is not a hypothesis. And I want to stop here to add some things. It's hypotheses, it's guesses that we make, theories about things that need proof. We don't need proof about what we directly experience. What we directly experience, we know is so. And my argument, when we get to it tomorrow, is going to be that that's how believers know God. By their experience of God. And that doesn't need proof. Don't be suckered into that, you know, what's your proof stuff. The answer is, God's not a theory. God's an experience report. So it doesn't need proof. And tomorrow I'll not only elaborate on that, but I'll be talking about what we say to the answer, which is inevitable to that. Well, it's not my experience, so I need proof. No, you don't. You need the experience. We'll come to all this. But anyway, notice that according to Kant, God's a hypothesis, and I'm saying that the Christian view of all of this is, number one, God's not a hypothesis. Okay. God's not merely a moral umpire. Does God preside in the judgment? Absolutely, in the person of Jesus Christ. Everyone comes before that throne. And those who have believed in and confessed their sin get a pass. They get a buy. They're not charged. And those that haven't get charged. But there are some believers that have done evil that needs to be punished yet. Jesus himself says that two men who said to him, he says in the final days when the judgment occurs, people are going to say to me, Lord, we're on your side. We did miracles in your name. And I'm going to say, depart from me, you workers of iniquity. I never knew you. And you have to think about people who believe it. I guess that it's genuine. I have to take them at their word. But do things like bless little children. Are horrible things. And the judgment remains. But God isn't just a moral umpire. He also happens to be the creator, sustainer of the entire universe, which is not just inside our minds. And the third thing is, according to Christianity, God has already made provision for the redemption of the entire world. Of course, Kant's not saying anything about that. Well, that's, as far as he's concerned, that's all on the, this is a myth side of the ledger, right? I read you what he wrote about Christ and the incarnation. And as it were, this idea comes down from heaven. And the idea, and we need to grasp that and believe in it and be motivated as though God is going to judge us, when in fact it's all not true. I don't know how that ever. I don't even know the point of putting that on paper. Who's going to do that? This is a lie, but live as though it's true. Yeah, how many people are going to do that? Nobody with any sense, it seems to me. Okay, there are other ways. First of all, or the next one is, there is a real judgment. Kant doesn't believe that, but that's part of the Christian message. The Christian message is mostly good news. Remember what the angels said on Christmas, the first Christmas? We bring you good tidings of great joy that'll be for all people. Okay. But for the people that still have this kind of awful, have done awful evils, there's a judgment, there's a reckoning going to come. Pope Benedict XVI has made a comment about this and may be helpful. He said, maybe the judgment is just appearing before Christ when we're raised. And when we see him and we see what he suffered for us, the grief and the repentance that will be engendered in us will be our punishment. That may be true too. Well, at least we have these contrasts. I wanted to draw them. That God is a postulate of the moral reasoning, and that everlasting life is no comfort and does us no good whatsoever. Because there are only ideas that we can't help but think about, but which can't possibly be true. But live as though they are. Right. Well, I feel like summarizing Kant's mistakes for us. I did that earlier, and I also mentioned some ways he improved on his predecessors. But let's just remind ourselves of what we've been told here. And we've been told, first of all, the given in experience motto. Okay, We're back. I lost my blackboard there for a minute, and it's recovered now. And I was about to summarize some of the mistakes, and I found that I was about to make one myself. There's one more topic that we haven't covered, and in Kant, and I'd like to do that, and then we'll summarize. So, it has to do with a big topic now. Free will. What's Kant got to say about that? Well, he affirms it. He says we have free will. We can know the moral commands, what the moral law wants us to do, and we can think about that as if it came from God, and as if it had been exemplified in an actual human life, such as Christ's life. We can do all of that, but we still are confronted by a choice, and we're free to make that choice. Now, this is a tough one for him. That's what he wants to say. So let me explain that the opposite, the denial of that, is called determinism. And this means that our choices are not freely made by us, they're determined by other forces or powers, influences, that force us to believe and act the way we do. Now you would think that from everything Kant has said about knowing, this is his big theory, see, his ground plan, this, you know, the architecture of the mind and all that, that we don't have any control over what's given. And all that other stuff is imposed on it automatically and unconsciously by our mind. And then our conscious mind deals with that as it's been made, so on. Where's the room for freedom? The laws of all the categories of the understanding are exceptionless. They're forced on us. It's cause and effect. It's forced on us. Now, of course, he's done two things. He's made our experience look entirely determined, but he's left the self outside the determined experience, so that he can say it's free. And that's what he tries to do. Look at this again. Let me explain determinism a little more. It's the claim that all our beliefs, and choices are forced on us by, and then the version of determinism fills in the blank with whatever it thinks are the powers that force us to choose and believe the way we do. Materialists are fond of saying that's the Big Bang. From that time on, all the atoms and subatomic particles have been developing the way that the Big Bang threw them out there in the first place. So ultimately, our choices are products of how our brains operate. Our brains operate is the result of other forces outside of and before us, traced all the way back to the Big Bang, given that it took place the way it did. We can't help but think what we do. Or it could be somebody would say that about the way we're potty trained or something. It doesn't matter what they put in the blank. They've got something that's making us do what we do and believe what we believe and choose what we choose. But no matter what that is, no matter how that blank is filled in, this theory, this position, is self-defeating. I want to be clear about why. Because when it says all our beliefs and choices are forced on us by, it doesn't matter what force it picks, it cancels itself. Because if all our beliefs and choices are forced on us by whatever, say, the Big Bang, then so is the belief that all our beliefs are forced on us by the Big Bang. And we don't know that either. We've not weighed evidence and gone through reasoning. It's not the product of seeing some things as self-evident and bringing in other evidence and so on and coming to some reasonable conclusion. No, according to what it says is that even it is believed for the same reason, namely, it's forced on those who believe it. I remember one day I was speaking with one of my colleagues in the philosophy department, and we were out in the hall, the students were switching classes, and I don't remember the topic of our conversation or what it was that I said that provoked this reaction, but a member of the English department walking by stopped, turned around and came back, and I don't know what she overheard, but she said to me, "Oh, do you believe in God?" And I said, "Yes." And, "Oh, you must have a high serotonin level in your frontal cortex." And I said, "Why? Are all our beliefs determined by the serotonin level of our frontal cortex?" And she said, "Yes." And I said, "Does that include the belief that all our beliefs are determined by the serotonin level in our frontal cortex?" And she said, "That's logic, and logic is a trick." Right. It's not that your claim is self-defeating. It's logic that's wrong. Never mind. This position is self-canceling. Because if it's true of all beliefs, it's true of itself. And if it makes all beliefs out to be forced on us by non-rational forces, and nothing's ever the product of any rational discourse or deliberation, then it's not knowledge. We don't know it. We believe it, but we can't say we know it. And that goes for this claim also. It sinks itself. And that's the reason I think free will is true, and I also believe that free will is everywhere presupposed in the New Testament. The New Testament has no statement that says, "And God gave people freedom." But everywhere God treats people as though they were free to act in one way or act in another. Believe or not believe. Do good or do evil. It's assumed everywhere. That's why God holds us responsible. But Kant wants that too. He wants that for his ethics. He wants to say people have free will, so he's against determinism. But his whole philosophy about how we experience anything is deterministic. But it has left the self outside that picture, and now he wants to tell us we should think of ourself as real also. So here is self, God, moral laws, or the moral law, for him it's the categorical imperative, self, God, moral law, and immortality. Since real goodness requires endless improvement, immortality are all somehow real. But if all the rest of his philosophy was worth anything, they're not. And he talks sometimes that one way that they're real, and other times another way, so we should treat them as if they were real. But of course, we can't believe they really are. Couldn't believe that. That's just foolishness. We have to invent the world and put in it what we want in it. That's what I find. That's how I see what he's doing. Well, remember that causality is involved here too. Causality was just supposed to be one of the categories of the understanding that the mind imposes on sense perceptions. But now he takes causality outside of just being that, and he wants to talk about the self being the real cause of our actions, able to obey or not obey the moral law, so free will is in the picture, and God as moral judge. This has annoyed a lot of commentators since, and it's not just my idea that Kant is inconsistent with himself. At times he talks about certain things as though they are only ideas, and he's very clear that they're not realities. And at other times, he's saying it's a practical necessity. There's a practical proof of God and the self and immortality and morality. And he calls it a practical proof. And it turns out to mean we need to think it. Well, maybe I need to think I'm rich, but that doesn't make me rich. We need to think it. Okay. But then sometimes he goes on to talk about all those entities as real. So, here's Kant plumping for free will. It's our last topic of, that we take of moral responsibility requires free will, Hume argues. I think that's right. But freedom is only an idea of the reason. It's a, what he calls elsewhere, sorry, a regulative concept. And that means it's an idea of the reason. It regulates how we think about other things. It can also be said to regulate how we act. Okay. There's real freedom. And how does that now comport with the fact that everything that comes into our minds from outside is a color, taste, touch, smell, or sound? And those are all rigidly determined by natural laws. What we experience is rigidly determined. You'd think that means it can't be altered by anything we do. Then how can it make a difference in the world whether we act morally or we don't? Put it this way, how can we act in that world? How can we be a player in that world? Because we are not just a sight, taste, touch, smell, or sound. He's still got the mind-body interaction problem. How does the self cause actions to take place in the perceptual room of his little house to describe the mind, when everything that determines what's there are the chaos that enters and the space and time and categories that are imposed on it? How do you and I change what's in there? I don't see him addressing that at all. He assumes that we are. But then the self would have to be real. He's right about that. It would have to be. In fact, to get any practical value out of belief in God, you'd have to believe God's real. So it does no good to say this is a practical proof of God's existence. We need him. That sounds like Voltaire. If God didn't exist, we'd need to invent him. But that's not the point. The point in Christianity is that we experience God and we know that he's real. That's the point. And we live in responsibility to God. And we have freedom to act in his world, because his world isn't just a little cubbyhole in our minds into which colors, tastes, touch, sounds, and smells come in. We know not from where. And then our minds make them into magic, make them into objects that have to obey all the laws of the categories of the understanding. And then we're to think that somehow ourselves, which is really only a regulative idea anyway, when he introduces it, could act in and change what happens next in the perceptual world. How's it going to do that? That's mind-body interaction, isn't it? Or mind, not mind, right? Between something between what's the mind and what's not the mind. The stuff that's going on inside it isn't the mind itself. The mind still has to interact with that for us to have any effect in it. But cause and effect is only a category of the understanding. It only applies to perceptions. It doesn't apply to minds. That's why they can be free. It's also why it can't act in the world. You get my drift, I think. I won't go on, because this kind of conceptual mess is what ends up with the guy who was determined at the outset to take on all the other philosophies, the traditional rationalisms and the empiricisms that have arisen, and put the best of each together and come out with a coherent picture. And he tries mightily, and he's no fool, but it doesn't cohere in the end. It has all the same problems, maybe worse than before. Well, we're going to conclude our discussion of Mr. Kant with that. And next time we'll take up a different topic altogether. So today you are going to have a shorter class. Dismiss early because it's a nice day outside and everybody wants to go there, I know. So I'll see you tomorrow.